Sports Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglul, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, we have an action-packed show planned as we recap the Bears game yesterday, and what an excuse for a game that was. We'll get to that first here in a moment. We've also talked about the MLB postseason in the past. We're going to bring that up again today and have a special guest come on later in the show. He's been a longtime contributor to Sports Talk Chicago, and now he'll be a first-time guest right here on WHPK. Len Casper, TV voice of the Chicago Cubs, will be joining us at around 9:30, and we'll be talking about the MLB postseason as well as the Cubs and their 2018 season in review. But before we get started, let's take care of a little housekeeping. You're listening to 88.5 WHPK-FM Chicago. You can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook at John Zaglul, or you can visit us at sportstalkchicago.com. All music is produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. So if you like what you've heard today, make sure to check him out in your spare time. Now, if you want to contribute to today's show and today's conversation, the phone lines are open and they'll be open all hour. So feel free to call in at 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. If you agree or disagree with what I'm saying, we're going to be talking about the Bears first. If you want to air your grievances on the game yesterday, you know the number. You can give me a call and we'll put you right on the air. So let's start today and talk about yesterday's excuse for a football game, because the Chicago Bears were fresh off of a bye week. They had a 3-1 record. They were leading the NFC North Division, yet they let Brock Osweiler, of all quarterbacks, and the Miami Dolphins as a team find a way to pull out an unprecedented win. And yesterday's game was just so sloppily played, you know, the Bears deserved to lose that game. And in the end, they ended up losing an OT as the clock ticked down to zero via the field goal by Sanders. So let's get into what happened yesterday, because what I find shocking is that Brock Osweiler somehow found a way to defeat the Bears. Now, if you're not familiar with Brock Osweiler, he's a career backup quarterback, and he's failed so many times before that the word failure and Brock Osweiler go hand in hand. He was with the Denver Broncos and did okay over there his first time around, then got this big mega contract because of his great half season with the Broncos taking over for Peyton Manning, and went to Houston and did horrible. And even though they went 8-6 with him as the starter, it was more so because of their defense that they did well, because that year he had 15 touchdowns, 16 interceptions, and threw for less than 3,000 yards. And after Houston and after what they saw, they were like, no, you know what, you're gone, you haven't proven yourself, so you're going to leave. Then he goes to the Cleveland Browns, and this was when the Browns, you know, weren't a good team. This is when they were horrible and had a QB problem. And he got cut out of training camp. This was a guy who couldn't even last with the Browns when they were winless, mind you, out of training camp. So he failed in Denver. He failed in Houston. He failed with the Browns, went back to Denver, did horrible, and now is with Miami and has found a way to defeat the Chicago Bears in a big game that had lots of implications for the Bears on top of it. Brock Osweiler, by the way, too, and this was an interesting stat that they kept talking about and alluding to in yesterday's game, 4-0 in his career against the Bears, which I guess he just has their number, but at the same time, it's like, come on, really? Especially with Miami beating the Bears yesterday. Just, you know, it was such a horrible game, and the fact that Osweiler succeeded and did well and found a way to win just makes me even more sickened. The Bears also yesterday, and this is something that I think people forgot about because Osweiler did so well, is the fact that their defense was not on point by any means. They had zero sacks, so that was the first time all year that the Bears did not record a sack in a game, first of all. Then you've got the fact that they gave up 100 yards rushing to Frank Gore, of all players. It's the first time all year that the Bears have given up 100 rushing yards to a running back. And why Frank Gore is my question. Frank Gore, you know what? I don't want to take anything away from him. He's going to be a Hall of Fame running back without a doubt. He's a great player. He's fourth all-time on the rushing yards list. But he's 35 years old this year, and in his past three seasons with Indianapolis, he's averaged less than 4 yards per carry. But for some reason yesterday, the Bears defense didn't show up, and Frank Gore averaged over 5 yards a carry in that game. And the Bears gave up 100 yards against him. I mean, that is just horrible defense. And if you're trying to point fingers at, you know, why the Bears lost, sure, Brock Osweiler had a good game and the Bears had problems defending him. But the run game, having Frank Gore, a 35-year-old washed-up running back, put up 100 yards against you is a telltale sign that you weren't going to win that game yesterday. And that's what happened to the Bears. They also had too many critical turnovers on offense. And Jordan Howard fumbling the ball at the goal line earlier in the game, I mean, that could have been a touchdown. The Bears would not have even had to go to overtime had they scored at that point. Tariq Cohen, too, had another fumble, and that was in OT. That was very critical as well. Luckily, the Bears ended up stopping the Dolphins on the goal line, of course, because Kenyon Drake fumbled, but in the end, they lost anyways. It was a sloppy game. And let's talk about Mitchell Trubisky, too, because I know everyone, let's put it this way. I talked about before how Trubisky, you know, you shouldn't get too high on him yet, but I'll give him credit. He battled through lots of adversity yesterday. He had no defense around him, obviously, with the fact that they gave up 100 yards to Frank Gore, the fact that the Bears let Brock Osweiler run wild on them. But still, Trubisky had a good game, believe it or not. 3 touchdowns, 1 interception. 22 of 31 for 316 yards. That's actually a solid game. My only criticism is the fact that Trubisky's interception occurred in the red zone. So the Bears had 2 turnovers inside the red zone. They could have gotten 14 points out of those 2 trips to the red zone, and instead, they throw an interception, and they fumble the ball on the goal line, which, that was my problem with them as well yesterday. So you've got a bad defense, you've got 2 turnovers in the red zone, and that right there explains to you why the Bears lost that game. They had multiple opportunities to win yesterday. The Howard fumble, the Cohen fumble, Trubisky interception, then in OT, the drive going downfield, leading to a missed field goal by Cody Parkey. And there was a quote by Parkey after the game saying, you know, I'm only human. You know, I mean, I missed the field goal, I'm only human. You know, I'm not perfect. I understand that, and, you know, they did put him in a tough situation because it was a long field goal. It was, what, like 53, 54 yards? But, you know, in Parkey's case, I think that that's a kick that has to be made. Your team's on, the game's on the line. You know, you're kicking for the win. You couldn't do it. Now, my one criticism on that aspect is, Matt Nagy maybe could have handled the play calling better because the Bears were so enthralled that they were going to be able to kick a field goal. Maybe instead of running the ball for 2 yards and having to kick a field goal, being forced into that situation on fourth down, the Bears could have, you know, driven a little further downfield and kicked a field goal from a closer distance. I think the Bears played too conservative on that one drive, and that forced Parkey to have to kick up a prayer, really, and a 54-yard field goal, and he missed it. It didn't work out, and in the end, the Bears ended up losing. But, you know, it was just a tough game all around. It was a game that the Bears didn't deserve to win, yet they had multiple opportunities to win nonetheless, and they just couldn't come through. Now, what does this mean for next week? Because now you've got New England coming into Soldier Field. They're 4-2. They won 3 straight. They won 3 of their last games, and they're on a hot streak. The Bears now are at 3-2, and I'm not confident in Mitchell Trubisky being able to defeat Tom Brady, even though the Bears are at home. Brady's going to come in here with Belichick, and, you know, with the Patriots. That's not going to be an easy win. That's not going to be an easy game in general for the Bears. So you have to assume now that the Bears are going in to the next week 3-3, and their division lead that was once, as we said, insurmountable. I mean, a 3-1 record coming out of the bye. They were the hottest team in the NFC North. The Vikings, the Packers, the Lions all had discourse within their organization. And now you've got the Bears all of a sudden collapsing already. A 3-3 record now? assuming they lose to the Patriots, that's not a good thing. They had the division lead, and now, depending on if the Packers win tonight, they'll be tied for the division lead, and if they lose next weekend, they're losing the division lead. Yesterday was a game that the Bears had to win, hands down. No questions about it, and they didn't come through. And now they're going to be collapsing in the division, all because of yesterday's game, in which they lost to a backup quarterback and Brock Osweiler because Ryan Tannehill didn't play. That, as shocking as it is the story after yesterday's game for the Chicago Bears. Did you know that 1 in 6 children in our country is obese? Being overweight puts kids at risk for high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, and many other ailments. Let's encourage kids across the Barrington area to engage in healthy, balanced, and active lifestyles. Reduce their time in front of the TV or computer and get physically active or properly maintain green space. And we can set an example by being physically active. For more information on preventing childhood obesity, visit usmayors.org/childhoodobesity. So let's shift gears from the deflating Bears and their loss yesterday and talk about some MLB postseason stuff, as right now we've got the Red Sox and the Astros in the ALCS and the Dodgers and the Brewers in the NLCS. So let's talk about that first series, the ALCS, the Red Sox, and the Astros. Right now, it's kind of an even series, although the Red Sox did blow the game the other night. My prediction so far for this Red Sox-Astros series, and you heard it here first, the Astros will beat the Red Sox, no doubt about it, simply because of their pitching. Verlander, you've got Justin Verlander, Gerrit Cole, Dallas Keuchel, and Charlie Morton, who's coming out of the bullpen even though he went 15-3 this year as a starting pitcher. That's one of the best rotations, if not the best starting rotation in Major League Baseball. And right now, the Astros have that advantage in pitching because the Red Sox pitching is so unproven and so inconsistent that it's not even funny. I mean, at the top of their rotation, sure, you have Chris Sale, and yes, he is a dominant pitcher. I'm not taking anything away from him. But in a 7-game series, realistically, how many starts are you going to get out of Chris Sale? Probably 2, maybe 3, if you really want to push him. So the other games are going to have to be filled by other starters, and that's common sense. But right now, the problem is the Red Sox don't have anyone else. David Price, whom they're paying over $30 million, has an ERA this postseason of 10. He has a 10 ERA this postseason, and this year had a 3.6 ERA, which is okay. But he's not doing well in the postseason. And what I find funny about David Price is that I think he is just completely sold out as a player. Once he got paid by the Red Sox, everything changed in his dynamic. The year before, when he had split time due to a trade with the Blue Jays and the Tigers at that time, he almost won the AL Cy Young Award. He went 18-5 in the regular season. He had a 2.45 ERA. He led the AL in ERA. He had 225 strikeouts. Then he gets paid by the Red Sox, and ever since he's gone there, his best ERA has been 3.38, but that was in limited time. If you're talking best overall season throughout a full year, it was this year, 3.58. That's not David Price. David Price was, at least, an elite pitcher in this game. Ever since he's gotten paid, he's sold out on the Red Sox, and now they can't depend on him here in the postseason. You've also got Rick Porcello. He won a Cy Young 2 years ago, which, of course, I can test, because just because he won 22 games, the ERA was like 3.3. Odd time to win a Cy Young Award for Rick Porcello. And this year, 17 wins. Oh, that's great. But a 4.28 ERA. And in the postseason, they've actually been using him more out of the bullpen, even as a setup man, because the Red Sox bullpen is simply horrendous. I mean, you've got Craig Kimbrell as your closer, but behind him, there aren't many good pieces. So you've got Porcello, who's out of the bullpen, really, Price, who is atrocious in the postseason, and Chris Sale, who does well but only gets 2 starts a series, and behind them, Eduardo Rodriguez and Nathan Eovaldi, both of those guys solid but unproven. Meanwhile, when you look at the Astros, as I mentioned, you've got 4 great starting pitchers. Just because of the pitching itself, the Astros are going to win that ALCS series. Let's move to the NLCS. talk about the Dodgers and the Brewers, and something that's wrong for the Dodgers right now, something that they need to be worried about, is Clayton Kershaw and his ineffectiveness in the playoffs. And it's odd because he is an all-time great already. If he retired today, I guarantee you Clayton Kershaw would be in the Hall of Fame, without a doubt. But because he's not doing well, in the playoffs, his career ERA in the postseason is over 4, and this year he has an ERA of 12 in the playoffs, which is simply horrendous too. You know, he's proving to be a liability more than an asset for the Dodgers, and that's a problem right now. If the Dodgers can't depend on Kershaw, which they can't right now in the postseason, they don't have any other pitchers that they can use at this point. I mean, they kept Alex Wood off the roster, which I thought was a mistake on their part. They've got Kenta Maeda, but he's more so out of the bullpen. Hyunjin Ryu has been the lone bright spot, but he's coming off an injury, so you have to wonder when the innings are going to catch up to him and affect his performance in the games. Then you've got Walker Buehler, a rookie who's done well, but again, unproven. How is he going to help you in the playoffs as a rookie? And he hasn't done well in the postseason, I have to say as well. He hasn't been able to perform the way he has in the regular season. Now, in the bullpen, the Dodgers have a strong bullpen. I mean, Kenley Jansen is the closer, and I know he's gone through some health problems this year, which has impeded his performance, but he's still a solid closer, a solid arm in the back of that bullpen. Scott Alexander, Pedro Baez, Daniel Hudson, all solid names. The bullpen is just that. It's solid. It's not great, but it's okay. Looking at the Milwaukee Brewers, now, actually, believe it or not, their starting rotation is just as bad as the Dodgers, but their bullpen, I can argue, is the best in baseball. Josh Hader is simply a beast. 6-1 record out of the bullpen. ERA under 2.5. Jeremy Jeffress, 8-1 record in the regular season. ERA of 1.29. I mean, come on. You can't compete with that. And I think that's why even if the Cubs had advanced and had to face the Brewers, they wouldn't have been able to beat him simply because the Brewers could go 4 or 5 innings with their starter and be done. And that's why they've been able to win. Maybe their starting rotation hasn't been solid in a sense, but it's been good enough to get them through 5, 6 innings on a good day, then have the bullpen come in and clean it all up. I mean, Josh Hader in game 1 of the NLCS went 3 shutout innings, and he was fine. It was like nothing to him. So the Brewers' bullpen is very strong. Their offense is solid. They've got a couple of good players in Jesus Aguilar and Christian Yelich and Lorenzo Cain. Ryan Braun is Ryan Braun. I mean, he's Ryan Braun without steroids, so take that as you will. He's hitting .254. So having a league average Ryan Braun, having an elite Christian Yelich and Lorenzo Cain, and having, you know, Jesus Aguilar, who had a great first half but tailed off in the second half, still hit 35 home runs. You've got that going on. I feel like the Brewers are going to find a way to pull out a series victory and move on to the World Series. And it'll be the first time for the franchise going to the World Series since 1982. And they deserve it this year. They have the best record in the NL. Of course, the Cubs coming in second, one game behind because they lost that playoff, game 163. But the Brewers are the hottest team in baseball right now. And as much as it pains me to say it, you know, they're going to probably win the NLCS. And I could see them moving on to the World Series. Now, depending on who they face, that's going to determine if they could win the World Series. I feel like if it's the Astros, they're going to have a tough time because of that starting rotation. If it's the Red Sox, however, if the Red Sox can somehow just plainly out-hit the Astros and make it all the way, then that will be a very good series, knowing that it could go either way. The Brewers are looking good. I think they can beat the Dodgers here in the NLCS and move on. And depending on who their AL opponent is, that will determine whether they're going to end up doing well and winning the World Series or end up losing. But either way, this is a great year for baseball in Milwaukee. They've found a way to really reinvigorate their fan base because they've had some problems in the past. And last year was okay, and the year before they ended up going under .500. So it's nice to see them rebound and not having a necessarily long rebuild as well. They won the NL Central in 2011. They had a couple of bad years. Last year they finished over .500 and missed the playoffs. And now this year They're heading to the NLCS already. They're already in it, and they could be heading to the World Series. So that's definitely a win for Milwaukee Brewers fans and a win for the city of Milwaukee. And it's also a win for the franchise itself, proving to everyone that you don't necessarily need to tank to end up doing well, you know, in the future. I mean, the Cubs ended up tanking, of course, and look at them now. They're great, but the Brewers are kind of the anti in regards to the Cubs. They're the opposite. They found a way to not necessarily buy their way, but make some nice trades, make some budget signings, and they've been able to win under Craig Counsell, and they've been able to move on already to the NLCS and possibly the World Series. So a great year for the Brewers so far, great year for Milwaukee baseball, and we'll see how long that success can last. Every 3.5 minutes, a child is diagnosed with cancer. The St. Baldrick's Foundation's mission is to conquer kids' cancer by funding the most promising research. But finding a cure, that's going to take everyone's help. Get involved or donate today, and to learn how, visit stbaldricks.org. So it's now time for the Sports Talk Chicago Flashback, as each week we'll be playing a newsworthy clip from one of my recent podcasts. So 3 weeks ago, I got to talk to Oliver Luck. He's the CEO and commissioner of the XFL Football League. He's also the father of Andrew Luck, the NFL player. So I talked with him, and it was interesting. We had a great conversation, first of all, but I got to a point about asking him about the league and who they're planning on signing, and I asked specifically about Colin Kaepernick, and he gave me, let's put it this way, an interesting answer. So I'm going to play this clip, and we'll give you an update soon when we come back, a score update, and then Len Casper coming on very shortly, so stay tuned for that interview as well. You're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM, Chicago. So I know you mentioned that you're not going to be competing with the NFL, but are you worried about the AAF? Because now they're starting a year earlier than you, and they're run by Charlie Ebersole. Do you see them as a problem to the success of the XFL?
No, I don't. You know, Charlie and Bill Polian have put together their league. They are in the markets that they're in, and, you know, they're going to launch in 19. You know, we're not concerned about them. We wish them luck and hope they do well, but we don't consider that to be, quite honestly, a competitor of ours.
Well, let's get into the logistics of the league. How many teams do you see being a part of it, and do you have an idea of which cities are being targeted to host some teams?
So we will launch our inaugural season in 2020 with 8 franchises. We have a very good idea of where those franchises will be, but we'll be sharing that information beginning in October. We'll be rolling out our various markets and the venues, and then establish the team identities as we go into the end of this calendar year and the first quarter of 2019.
And obviously, you know, you can't have teams without players. So how is the league planning on finding players? Are you guys planning on having a draft or recruiting players right out of college or former pros? How is that all going to come about?
Yes, 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 and yes. So we, you know, think about this for a moment. Most folks don't really realize this, even sort of diehard football fans. This past September 1st was the big cutdown for the NFL season, right? After training camp, the 32 teams, you know, announced the players who would be cut, right? They go from 90 basically down to 53. There were 1,100 players released by the National Football League. These are players, you know, there's some young guys, there's some older guys in that group. There's always, you know, players that people say, wow, he got cut. I thought he was pretty good. He had a 7 or 8 year career. So there's a lot of very talented football players who just aren't quite good enough to make it year in, year out with the National Football League. I'm telling you, you know, I can say this as a former player and the father of a current player. It's hard to make a 53-man roster. It really is. So I believe that the pool of talented players coming out of the colleges is broader and deeper than ever. There are, you know, it's bad grammar, I apologize, but there are more better players out there. And that's a real tribute to college football, not just the big programs, but all the way down to the, you know, FCS schools and in the you know, Division II and Division III schools. There's no question about that. So we think there'll be a plethora of players who are good quality players that our fans will recognize, who've had experience with NFL teams, maybe got cut, maybe stuck around for a couple, 3 years, but want to continue to play. And you mentioned one thing, which is, you know, college players without NFL experience. Obviously, we are not subject to the NFL's collective bargaining agreement. That's the agreement between the league and the union of NFL players that restricts players from being eligible in the NFL. They have to be 3 years out of high school, right? Using, you know, considered the three-year rule. Well, we're not subject to that rule. So conceivably, theoretically, we could take a guy who's played 2 years of college football who says, you know, I don't want to get beat up for a third year. I'm not interested in academics to begin with, or I'm about to flunk out. Yeah, I'll come play in the XFL. So that's an opportunity as well. We don't think that'll be, you know, a big source of our players, but, you know, it very well could be.
So what about a player who maybe is good enough to be in the NFL but isn't on a current team, like Colin Kaepernick? Would that be someone that the league is willing to give a contract to?
Well, you know, we haven't signed any players at this point. Our plan is to begin looking at players during the first quarter of 19, particularly looking at quarterbacks. So I'd rather not make comments on any particular individual. But, you know, certainly there are a lot of good players out there, guys with NFL experience, guys without NFL experience necessarily. Some great players that are up in Canada that may be interested in returning home. You know, we hear about the guys up in the CFL who are playing very well, who, you know, who would rather play in the U.S., quite honestly, because they're American citizens. So I'd rather not comment on any particular individual, but, you know, we're going to take a deep, long look at a lot of players, and because we think, you know, our eventual pool of about 450 or so will be those guys who are just that little notch below what it takes to make it in the National Football League.
I know you don't want to comment on Kaepernick, and that's fine, but, you know, he started, obviously, the anthem protest in the NFL. Do you see the XFL maybe allowing its players to take a knee if they wanted to during the national anthem? Has that been a topic of discussion so far?
Well, Vince McMahon, our owner, has said to me that he wants our players in the XFL, you know, to stand for the flag and respect the flag. So, you know, I don't think that we'll see our players taking a knee.
So that was Oliver Luck. Really fun interview with him, and a funny answer there when I asked him about Colin Kaepernick. Kind of dodged the question, but in the end, you know what? The XFL, interesting football league, and I hope you guys watch once it starts up in 2020. It's now time for the STC update. Some score updates from yesterday. The Vikings won 27-17 over the Arizona Cardinals. The Texans win 20-13. They improved to 3-3 under Deshaun Watson over the Bills. The Pittsburgh Steelers pull out a close one. They win 28-21 over the Cincinnati Bengals and improve to 3-2-1. The Atlanta Falcons win a shootout against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and Jameis Winston, who started in his first game this year, 34-29. In the MLB, the ALCS, the Boston Red Sox with a big win. They won 7-5 yesterday, the series all tied up at one apiece. In the NHL, the New Jersey Devils beating the San Jose Sharks to improve to 3-0-0. They win 3-2 in regulation. The Winnipeg Jets, 3-1 win over the Carolina Hurricanes. And the Anaheim Ducks, a 3-2 win over the St. Louis Blues. They improve to 4-1-1. That has been your STC update. We now head to the phones. We have our very special guest on the line right now. And let me give you a bit of an introduction and tell you a bit about him. He began his sports media career in 1994, hosting a daily sports radio show on WTMJ AM in Milwaukee. He then transitioned into the broadcast booth, calling Beloit Snappers games while doing fill-in work for the Milwaukee Brewers. After calling two seasons of Florida Marlins baseball, he became the Cubs TV play-by-play broadcaster in 2005 and today just finished his 14th season with the team. Please welcome Len Casper to the show. Len, how are you doing today? And thank you for joining me here on today's show.
Great to be with you, John. Doing fine. Couple of weeks, unfortunately, into the off season, but I think the Cubs overall, you know, felt good about the 95 wins, but bad about the way the season ended for obvious reasons. And as you look ahead to 2019, I think they feel that the window is very much open. Very tough division, as we know, but It's been a good ride here, four straight trips to the postseason, and you never want to take those things lightly or for granted, for sure.
Definitely. So what do you make of this 2018 season? Because, I mean, the Cubs, as you mentioned, won 95 games, had the second-best record in the National League, but obviously ended up losing to the Brewers in game 163, then lost subsequently in the wild card game. What do you make of this season for the Cubs?
It was a really strange year in that, you know, you win 95 and you feel like smooth sailing, everybody's feeling good. As you said, you're one game off having the best record in the league. But I think the fact that the offense struggled so much in the second half, it just never felt like the Cubs really got on a roll. Obviously, their bullpen was really good from start to finish. The starting rotation struggled a bit in the first half, very good in the second half. This team is kind of the first team under Joe Maddon that really had to battle a lot of injuries. And for the most part, I think they should be proud that they got through a lot of that adversity. And the other thing, too, John, I think when we assess a season, we tend to kind of block out what other teams around you do. But I think you have to give the Milwaukee Brewers a lot of credit. They just lost for the first time in 13 games the other day. When you have a team that hot at the end of the season, you know, you just have to tip your cap sometimes. And as good a division as it was, in the end, maybe the Brewers were just a little bit better. I know that's no consolation for a lot of Cub fans, and it's certainly not consolation for the team. But I think if you're looking at it objectively, it was a good season that unfortunately ended much more quickly than you had anticipated. And I think the main reason was just for whatever reason, the Cubs weren't able to score enough runs.
You know, that the Cubs weren't able to score enough runs, and you know, now recently the Cubs have announced that they fired hitting coach Chili Davis. What are your thoughts on that in relation to their offensive troubles in the second half?
Well, I don't think Chili was blamed for the Cubs' offensive struggles. I think that's a very difficult job, maybe the most difficult on a coaching staff. We're still trying to put our arms around just what sort of impact, if any, does a hitting coach have. Typically, guys know their swing. They are who they are, so to speak, as offensive players. And, you know, you give him credit if you're going to go down the list for the year Javier Baez had. An MVP-type season for sure. Anthony Rizzo, by the end of the year, had a very typical Rizzo-type season. Jason Hayward, I thought, had a really good year. Ben Zobrist had his best offensive season as a Cub. But for whatever reason, and the Cubs were very good in the first half. They were scoring over 5 runs a game and leading the league in a lot of offensive categories. But it all changed after the break, and I think that's the head-scratcher. That's the one thing people can't quite figure out. Obviously, they didn't hit as many home runs as they did the year before. They hit for a high average. They did strike out less than they had in the past while continuing to take their walks. You know, I just think you're trying to thread a needle sometimes in terms of the instruction. Chili Davis knows hitting. There's no question about it, and basically, John, my experience over the years, hitting coaches are generally saying the same things. It's just, I guess, the way it's delivered and the way it's received, and you know, it's a job where the second you get hired, the clock is ticking, and even if you, by the end of the year, have good numbers, and the Cubs basically finished in the top 5 in the National League in most categories, I think it's the way they finished that people tend to remember, unfortunately.
Len Casper here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Len, let's go to the postseason now, featuring the Milwaukee Brewers. You know, 4 teams left remaining. Who do you see advancing to the World Series, and do you have a pick to win it all?
I'm terrible at predicting, especially when you have 2 series tied at 1. You know, it comes down to a bit of a coin flip. I haven't watched a whole lot of the postseason. We had 42 out of 43 to finish the year, so I went through a little baseball detox, but I think the Dodgers winning game 2 was really big, and having 3 at home in a row here is huge, so I might give a slight edge to the Dodgers in the National League. I think the American League is very even. Again, because they're headed to Houston and the Astros have the three in a row at home, I might give them the slight advantage. But, you know, I think the combination of any of the matchups in the World Series are still very possible. And I think both series could go seven.
I wanted to go back now to the Cubs and the offseason coming up, because obviously with these offensive troubles, you think maybe they're going to go out and spend some money this offseason. What do you see the team targeting? And, you know, what are the needs that the Cubs have going into next year? How are they going to improve this team to improve the outcome next season?
It's a great question. I think it's a tough one to answer right now. When you do have a disappointing finish, and I think Theo has talked about it a lot, you know, emotionally, when the season ends, a lot of people look at, you know, you got to do this, you got to do that, you got to get rid of this guy, you got to sign that guy. But typically, when you take a step back and you have a little separation from the end of the season and a little more objectivity, you realize that the foundation of this club is its young position players. And you still, I think, believe that these guys are going to all get it together. You know, it doesn't always happen at the same time, as we know. Can you count on Javier Baez having the same offensive season next year that he had this year? Maybe not. But you hope a few other guys ascend to the point where you feel like collectively the offense is where it should be. So I don't think they'll overreact whether they go out for a potential big free agent to help this offense remains to be seen. I'd be surprised if Cole Hamels doesn't return. They've got a $20 million option on him, and I thought he was exactly what they needed. Jesse Chavez was a godsend for their bullpen. I think you have to make sure that you're covered in terms of Brandon Morrow. If he's not fully healthy next year, you want to make sure you've got good options behind him. So I think they have some pitching questions to answer, maybe even before you get to the offense. And I think there is a lot of depth position player-wise. So you might see one or two additions in all areas, but for the most part, I think this club will look pretty similar to the one that won 95 this year.
Okay, so here's the million-dollar, or let's put it this way, $400 million question. Do you see the Cubs signing or going after Bryce Harper in this offseason?
My bottom line answer is I have no idea. My just personal gut reaction to that question is I would say less likely than more likely due to the money he will command. I think I think the Nationals will make him a competitive offer, and he has not closed the door to returning. It sounds like the Phillies have some money to spend and might go after him pretty hard. So, you know, not that you're going to overspend for a guy of his caliber, but you're going to have to pay a lot of money to get him, and that may not allow you to do some other things that you want to do with your payroll and your ball club. So, you know, anything is possible, John, but I guess I would be more surprised than not if they were able to pull that off.
Now, I do also want to talk about a pressing matter for the Cubs as far as the middle infield goes, because of Addison Russell and how his season ended via suspension for domestic violence allegations. Now, it's a 40-game suspension that was retroactive to September 21st, so he has just under 30 games to go, but there's been lots of speculation, people saying that he'll never play another game in a Cubs uniform. Do you ever see Addison Russell making a return to this team?
Another good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think there are a lot of other things on a personal level that have to happen before we even get to that question. And I think if you asked Theo Epstein that very question, he would give you a similar answer. I think they're probably right now kind of going through the process of recapping the MLB investigation and how they determined the suspension, and making sure that his family and he have the Cubs' support. And once you get to a point where you feel comfortable that everyone's on the same track, so to speak, I think then you make those big decisions. So I don't know the answer to that. It certainly was a devastating story that came out on a personal level that had nothing to do with baseball. And I think MLB did the right thing. And I think the rules they have in place now in that particular area have been a really good thing. So we'll see how it plays out. And I think over the course of the next 3 or 4 months, we'll get some more answers to that question.
So let's say, and we assume that maybe Russell, you know, isn't coming back. What do you think the Cubs will do in the middle infield? Because they can move Bias to shortstop, but you're losing Daniel Murphy via free agency. Do you see the Cubs maybe making a move, not necessarily a big one, but some sort of move to shore up the depth in the middle infield?
Well, I think they do have some depth, and whether or not David Bote becomes either a most-time or full-time player remains to be seen. Obviously, offensively, he struggled after a really hot start, but he can catch the ball, and I think, you know, has proven he's a big league player. So I think he gives you depth at a multiple positions. So he could almost become kind of the next Ben Zobrist, in my opinion, a guy who can play a lot of different spots. Zobrist, I think, will be a guy you certainly look to play a lot at second base. You mentioned Baez, his ability to play short. So I think they do actually have depth, not only on the infield, but in the outfield. Chris Bryant can play third base, first base, all three outfield spots. So, you know, Ian Happ, another guy who can move around and play some infield too. I think they feel fairly comfortable there. They could go out and maybe add some depth. But for the most part, I don't think there's necessarily a gaping hole at a particular offensive position. You know, the other one is making sure Wilson Contreras comes back and is more of the guy they had in the first half than the offensive player in the second half. He really struggled down the stretch. And that could just mean that Victor Caratini could push him a little bit for playing time. I thought he really emerged, and you feel pretty good about your catching tandem, too. And then I mentioned Chris Bryant, making sure he's healthy and that shoulder does not come back to haunt him again in 2019. If you look at some of the rate stats, he actually had a decent year. He just wasn't on the field enough. And, you know, that's a big adjustment for a guy who was used to basically playing every day the first 3 years of his career.
Now moving to some personal news, I had mentioned in your bio that, you know, this was your 14th year calling Cubs baseball. So how much does that mean to you, being the voice of a storied franchise for such a long time?
It means the world to me, and, you know, I thought a lot about, you know, just how I got here and how quickly this has gone. 14 years sounds like a long time, but, you know, they say time flies when you're having fun, and that is certainly the case, especially these last 4 years with the Cubs really being in the golden era of the franchise's history. I am honored every day to walk into Wrigley Field and to be able to call Cubs games. I love being able to do a little radio in the postseason with Pat and Ron. I have a great partner on TV, Jim Deshaies. We have a ton of fun, a lot of laughs, and I look forward to next year. I'm already ready for spring training, to be honest with you, John. You know, it's nice to have maybe a few weeks off to recharge the batteries, but I'm already excited about next season, and I'm a very lucky guy, and I certainly understand the responsibility and how big a job this is, and I never take it for granted.
What was the most fun era for you to call Cubs games? Would you say the 2007-08 era or this past era with the World Series championships?
Oh, the 07-08 Lou Piniella era was a lot of fun, but I don't know if we'll ever top what's gone on here the last 4 years under Joe Maddon, and to see this young club become almost a dynasty at this point has been really rewarding, and I think it's going to last for a long time to come. I don't think the Cubs will be satisfied with just one World Series championship in this window, and to be able to see guys like Anthony Rizzo every day and Chris Bryant and Javier Baez, and to watch John Lester kind of take this thing to the next level, to see what Jake Arrieta did when he won the Cy Young and just had that amazing run, the emergence of Kyle Hendricks. It's really been amazing. Pedro Strop, who's arguably been one of the, if not the best relief pitcher in the history of this franchise, You've got a lot of guys here who are going to be all-time Cubs, and maybe a couple will have their numbers retired at some point down the road, and a couple will end up in the Hall of Fame as well. So I think we're going to remember this era as the best probably in the history of this franchise.
And, you know, this year specifically, going back to that, there were lots of epic moments, including Jason Hayward's walk-off grand slam and Albert Almora's walk-off single and so many more. What was your favorite moment to call this season?
I'm not sure if there was one in particular. I just would say this. It probably involved Javier Baez stealing home in New York on the pickoff throw to first. He just, at every turn, did something where you said to yourself, how did he do that and nobody else could do it? It just his ability to create something out of nothing. So I would just say Javier Baez in general was kind of the highlight of the year for me.
And Len, before we let you go here today, I noticed on Twitter that you shared a picture of Len Dawson's jersey and captioned it by saying, "My namesake, true story." So naturally, I have to ask here, what's the story behind that?
Well, I was born in January, right around Super Bowl time, and I believe that particular Super Bowl was the Kansas City Chiefs and the Minnesota Vikings, and the game happened to be on in the hospital room, and my dad was a big sports fan, and they basically saw Len Dawson was the quarterback for the Chiefs and thought, Len is a pretty cool name, and let's name our child Len. So that's how I became named after Len Dawson. I was able to interview him maybe 20, 25 years ago and mention that story, and he was touched by that, and obviously was a great quarterback. And I was honored to be named after such a great football player, and it was cool when we were in Kansas City to see that, so I had to snap a picture of it.
Well, Len, thank you so much for joining me here today. Always a pleasure chatting with you, and hope to have you on again down the road.
That sounds great, John. Congrats on all your success, and best of luck with the show.
Thank you. That was Len Casper. What an honor to have him on. I love talking with him. Always great, insightful Cubs conversation. And I'm really happy that he took the time to call in and, talk some Cubs, talk about that season, and then also talk about some great moments in his career and his namesake, which we didn't know until today. So very interesting. Really happy he took the time to come on. So it's now time for the announcer's call of the day, a signature segment right here on Sports Talk Chicago. Today we had Len Casper on to talk some Cubs baseball and MLB news, so it's only fitting that we play one of his best calls from this past season, one that I alluded to during the interview. At the time, the Cubs were trailing by 2 runs in the bottom of the 9th inning. They had the bases loaded with 2 outs, and Jason Hayward had worked the count to 2-2. Let's listen in as Len Casper, as always, makes an amazing call.
Cubs have the bases loaded with 2 outs. And a 2-2 count on Hayward. The 2-2 pitch. There's a drive deep right. Cubs win! Cubs win! On a grand slam by Hayward!
Wow.
Can you believe that? Hitting 139. Against lefties.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of improbable here tonight. How sweet does that feel for Jason Hayward? Pile on, boys!
And the 2-2 pitch. Hayward hits a hot fly ball, deep right field. That goes Altair. It's got a chance! Grand slam! Grand slam, Jason Hayward! Cubs win!
So anyways, a great call there by Len Casper. You heard Pat Hughes later on. Always a pleasure, as I said, to have Len on, and really fun to talk some Cubs baseball. Now, right now we have a caller on the phone, so let's get him on the air. Caller, this is 88.5 WHPK Sports Talk Chicago. How are you, and thanks for calling in?
I'm good, John. Thank you. So the Giants are now 1-5. Is it time for them to move on from Eli?
Okay, great question. So some national football talk about Eli Manning and the Giants. I say yes. He has been horrendous this season. I'm very disappointed in his performance. And, You know, I was thinking, the Giants had the number two pick in the NFL draft this year, and they decide to go after Saquon Barkley, which, again, no knock on Barkley himself, but they decide to go after him instead of investing in a future quarterback. They think Davis Webb is the answer. I don't agree with that sentiment at all. There were five, you can make an argument, even six quality good quarterbacks in this draft, and the Giants didn't take advantage of that number two pick. They took Saquon Barkley, and again, he's a great player, don't get me wrong, but did the Giants necessarily need a running back this year? I don't think so. I think they should have taken a quarterback to rein in and have replace, eventually, Eli Manning, possibly this year or the year after. But yeah, those are my thoughts on Eli Manning and his situation right now with the Giants. Thank you for calling in. Any other questions?
Not that's it for now.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate the phone call. We'll talk about that for a minute. You know, Eli Manning, he's not having a great year. And I know 6 touchdowns, 4 interceptions, that's all right. But he's leading his team to a 1-5 record. The offense is completely stagnant with him at the helm. I mean, Odell Beckham, he's not getting him going. The only guy who's producing is Saquon Barkley, but he's a running back. They could just hand it off to him, and he'll find the holes and make things happen. And, you know, it's a shame what's happened to the Giants right now. They didn't take advantage of that draft position, and I think that's going to come back and haunt them for a while, because who knows if they're ever going to get another opportunity to have a great draft class. I mean, this year, yes, they can get a top 5 pick just because of their mediocrity, but the QB pool, the QB draft class for this year is atrocious. It's nothing compared to last year, where you've got guys like Darnold, Allen, Rosen. You know, those are guys who are quality figures, and those are all guys who can do better than Peyton Manning and have been. Even Baker Mayfield's doing better and leading the Browns to victory. Meanwhile, you've got, you know, Eli Manning, who was a great quarterback at one point, but now his career and his days are numbered in the NFL, and he's leading the Giants into the ground. They're 1-5 this year. They're, you know, horrible. And now it's just a matter of, getting something done. But anyways, yeah, I mean, the Eli Manning saga, the era of Eli Manning, it's ending very soon for the Giants, and I feel like that after this year, they're seriously going to have to consider making a move in regards to quarterback. Something that I heard, an interesting theory about the Manning saga, is that why didn't the Giants go on and get Teddy Bridgewater? That's a great question. Bridgewater right now is backing up for the New Orleans Saints, but the Saints are expecting him to inherit the offense once Drew Brees leaves. And Brees, now that he just broke the passing record, he could be on his way out very soon as well. So that's why Bridgewater's over there. Now, as far as Teddy Bridgewater and, you know, his merits, that's an entirely different story. I personally feel that Bridgewater is quite an overrated quarterback, but in the right system, I guess it's possible that he can thrive. So, you know, the Giants lost out there too. They could have made a trade, gotten him from their counterparts, the Jets, and made something happen. They decided not to do that. They didn't draft a quarterback with the number 2 overall pick. I mean, it's like, what are you doing? You need a quarterback. Eli Manning is not the answer anymore. And although he has the 2 Super Bowl rings, he's not a great quarterback. He never has been. He's always been in the shadow of his brother. The Giants had a chance this year. They blew it. And now, come next year, the year after that, no matter how long they mire in mediocrity for, they're never going to have another QB class like this year, meaning that they're never going to get a better opportunity to find a better quarterback. They blew their opportunity this year, and now it's over for the Giants. I'm surprised, well, actually, I'm not surprised about the idea that, you know, Odell Beckham, too, is complaining. He just signed a mega extension. He's going to be with them for the long haul, and now he's going to have, you know, Eli Manning as his quarterback for this year, and then, you know, who knows who after, because they didn't draft a good one. So he's going to be suffering, and his stats are going to be suffering, because receivers always depend on their quarterbacks. So Odell, the only person who's not suffering in this situation is Saquon Barkley, because he can make things happen by himself. He's that electric of a player. And I know the Giants did need a running back because they've had problems in the past. I mean, last year, their starter at one point was Orleans Darkwell, which is just, you know, I mean, that is, talk about mediocre. and they had Rashad Jennings before, and it seems like the last time that they had a good running back was back when they had Brandon Jacobs and Ahmad Bradshaw both rushing, and they had to split carries. But since then, you know, they've had running back troubles, and it was wise of them, or at least in their eyes it was wise, to grab a running back. But you have to realize that a quarterback is more valuable to your team than a running back. You can go out and get anybody. You could have gone out and gotten Adrian Peterson, for crying out loud. He's been out there forever. The Redskins scooped him up, and they're getting a bargain. Everyone thought Adrian Peterson was washed up. That's because last year, he was with the New Orleans Saints and never got consistent carries. Adrian Peterson's a guy where you need to give him the ball 20 to 30 times a game for his stats to be inflated, for you to see the benefits of what he's done. You could have went out and gotten him. You didn't need to go spend and waste a draft pick to get Saquon Barkley when you know that you need a quarterback. Eli Manning's career's over. It's been over. And the Giants just wasted an opportunity, plain and simple. I'm not even a Giants fan, and it irritates me knowing that they had a great opportunity to draft a quarterback. They could have even gotten Lamar Jackson. You know, I mean, he's been doing well with the Ravens. He hasn't been passing necessarily, but they've been using him in a specific way based on running. They usually have him take direct snaps and just run the ball twice or three times a game, and that's going well. And eventually, he's going to succeed Joe Flacco and become the new starting quarterback. And I'll tell you what, when that happens, the Ravens are going to become the team of the NFL. I'm saying it right now, because he is such an electric player that everyone is going to jump on that bandwagon, similar to what the Browns are doing with Baker Mayfield. So you could have gotten Lamar Jackson. He went 31st overall. The Giants could have moved up, traded up if they didn't want to. The Giants could have traded down to 4 or 5 and still gotten a good quarterback. And they didn't do that either. I mean, the opportunities are endless for the Giants, and they just totally, totally blew that situation. And now they're stuck with Eli Manning. They're stuck with an aging Eli Manning, and their season is on the fritz as it is. They're already 1-5 this season. Well, that does it for us today. I hope you enjoyed our show. Really fun time talking with Len Casper, talking about some football, some baseball. We didn't get to Jimmy Butler yet, but we'll be getting to that soon. Again, I'm John Zaglul, host here on Sports Talk Chicago. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook and LinkedIn at John Zaglul. Also, you can tune into SportsTalkChicago.com for articles, podcasts, and more special interviews. Please remember to tune in next Monday and every Monday at 9 a.m. to get your latest Chicago sports fix. And I'd like to thank the University of Chicago and show contributor Len Casper coming on today's show. We'll sign off with music by TMMRW. So long, everyone.
listening to WHPK 88.5 FM. I'm covering today on the electronic format, but tune in each week to hear some lo-fi hip-hop and alternating weeks Midwest House. And for today, I'll be playing some lo-fi hip-hop as well, so enjoy some chill tunes.
Do you still think about girls a lot?
Yeah. I think about girls a lot.